Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Peter Heller is the best-selling author of the new novel, Burn, a novel about two men, friends since boyhood, who emerge from the woods of rural Maine to a dystopian country racked by bewildering violence. After weeks of hunting off the grid, the men reach a small town and are shocked by what they find. A bridge blown apart, buildings burned to the ground, and bombed-out cars abandoned on the road. Trying to make sense of the sudden destruction all around them, they set their sights on finding their way home, scavenging from boats left in lakes and dodging armed men as they seek a path to safety. Then a startling discovery drastically alters their path and the stakes of their escape. Peter Heller is the author of The Last Ranger, The Guide, The River, The Painter, and The Dog Stars. Heller is also the author of four nonfiction books, including Kook, What Surfing Taught Me About Love, Life, and Catching the Perfect Wave. It is a treat to welcome Peter Heller before a live audience at the Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont.
Do you see this as something different for you?
I don't know. I mean, it is, I guess it's dystopian. And so maybe it's a little like The Dog Stars. And there's also two friends who are trying to make their way through this kind of catastrophic and bleak landscape. And I've done that before, too. But what was really cool about this is, you know, I start with the first line. I never plot or outline. I came up as a poet, and I'm not that great a poet, but I really love the music and the language. I grew up loving the sound of language, and I'm more interested in that than story most of the time. And so I start with the first line, whose sound I love, and then just kind of follow it into the second, the cadence, and the story rides the back of the language. And what was so cool about this is it begins with this guy above a lake at night smelling char, and come to find out that a town has been burned to the ground, and then his friend is there, apparently, and I didn't know what was going on, and I had to discover it with the characters.
The characters in this novel, Jess and Story, and they are friends, and they've been friends for a long time.
Yeah, they grew up in Putney, Vermont, which is where I did go to high school, where my cousins live, where my dad went to high school, where my uncles went, where my mom's first cousins and her sister, sort of in the family, and they both grew up a mile away from each other on a dirt road. They went through school, kindergarten to high school, were often at each other's family's houses, helped each other's families get the wood in, sugar, all that. So they're really like brothers. They know each other that well.
And the fact that they're going through this, and we'll talk about what this is, but they're going through this together seems appropriate because they're, even though they know each other so well, they still surprise each other.
Yeah, and there's some big secrets, too, which are revealed in the book, which shocked me, I got to say. I mean, it kind of set me back. But what's cool about it is, you know, they're really forgiving with each other and accepting, but they're also hard with each other when they need to be. And I thought the friendship was really resilient and moving. And I loved, you know, any time those guys were together in conversation, I just loved it.
The idea of what has caused the dystopia, if you will, of what has happened to this town, why it's been burned, why it has been so ravaged, takes place in Maine. Mm-hmm. And so the whole thought of succession, and that there's some idea of that, but they still don't know exactly. They're putting the pieces together.
Yeah, and you know, these two guys are in their mid-30s now, and they meet every fall to go hunting or fishing, and now they're in north central Maine. They're moose hunting, and I didn't know. I mean, I called my agent. I wrote a few pages, and I called him, and I said, I don't know what's going on. He said, well, I don't either. You know, just keep going, and I didn't know whether it was, you know, aliens, where there was sort of a War of the Worlds sort of thing, because it was so strange. I mean, these towns are burned to the ground. There's no bodies or just a couple. And there's cars overturned on the road and shoes in the road. And it seemed to me like a kind of a cool alien movie, but I didn't. And then I thought maybe it's the Canadians. Yeah. Maybe, I mean, they're so polite and maybe they just snapped, you know, it's like.
When in doubt, blame the Canadians.
Yeah, man, let's just go invade Maine. I mean, we've been polite for way too long. So I seriously didn't know. And it was really thrilling, you know, trying to, you know, just getting the clues with these guys.
But I thought it was fascinating that there was the thought of, oh, well, this is a part of the United States that doesn't want to be a part of the United States anymore, perhaps. And what's fascinating about that is how many parts of the United States often feel that they no longer want to be part of the United States.
Oh, man, Joe. I read a poll. They did a poll like a month ago. I think it's 23% of Americans feel that their state should secede. And most of those think that it's in the Constitution. For some reason, they think that. And 31% of Texans think that Texas should secede. And I wonder, they didn't ask the rest of the country, how many people think Texas should secede? They should have asked that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's fascinating because it's something that – well, we think about, and when I was a reporter for a long time, it was every year the Adirondack Park was looking to get out of New York State. They were looking to go off on their own, become their own state.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Don't worry, they didn't. And then, actually, my wife was just reading to me today about Key West, apparently, the Keys.
Oh, yeah, but those guys, they're drinking too many margaritas all the time.
Oh, well, sure.
They're just crazy down there.
Probably what brings Eastern, a lot of it on, doesn't it?
I think it's Eastern Oregon wants to secede and join Idaho. Is that right? I mean, the fractures are everywhere.
So is that something specifically you wanted to explore?
I think so. I mean, you know, when you write the way I do, when you just start with the first line and don't have a plan and just let it rip, what happens is you end up bumping in within a few pages to whatever's really concerning you, you know, what's on your heart. And I think I must have been thinking a lot about the fissures that are opening up, the divisions in the country. I think it's so sad. I mean, I mean, maybe it's time-worn to say, but we're a big-hearted people. We really are. Everywhere you go, people are generous and amazing, innovative, great senses of humor everywhere you go in the country. And to have this kind of – be in this place where there's two sides and they can't talk to each other, I think it's heartbreaking.
Peter Heller is our guest. The name of the new novel is Burn. It is published by Knauf. The idea also that the secession is one thing – but the violence is another. I mean, that is how we get there, or how this happens is frightening because that seems so all too real.
Yeah, and I'm really fascinated by the idea that you could go away for a few days and come back, and the world could be completely different too.
Yeah,
I think that's really interesting. I was guiding a river trip in Costa Rica once for 4 days, and we were in the
I've done that.
In the rainforest. And we came out, and the Berlin Wall had fallen.
Yeah.
And it wasn't on our radar at all 4 days, you know, 4 days before. And I think that's just incredible. It's like our whole world can just tip on its axis.
What also I love about this novel is that you have two people. It's very tightly set. There's not a lot of movement in the sense of you have two characters and they're dealing with this situation, and there isn't a lot of outside stuff other than what's immediately before them that they're trying to figure out.
Right. I'm not too great at multitasking. I like keep it simple. But then there's a lot about their friendship too. I mean, they're dealing with this civil strife and trying to survive, but it's also really a book about friendship.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Well, very much about friendship and trust. So when did you start bumping into that?
I think right away. I mean, So they both have their burdens. You know, Story, who lives in Burlington, Vermont, has two young daughters. The older is 13, and she's a cross-country runner, star cross-country runner, but she also has an eating disorder, and it's exacerbated by stress, and it was almost fatal anorexia. And so Story is incredibly anxious and worried about his family and his daughter, what they're going through, knowing he's up in Maine in the middle of a civil war and he can't get in touch with them. So he's got that going on. He's incredibly stressed out by that. And then Jess, who lives in Colorado and is a woodworker, his wife left recently, just left him flat, and his dog died. And so he's like a walking country song. So they're both dealing with these issues. And then right away, they're very tender with each other. You know, Story's trying to get on the – she's trying to reach, you know, cell phone service. And he can't and everything. And Jess is very patient with him and finally suggests, hey, maybe we ought to turn off the phones now and save the batteries for when, you know, we need it for navigation. And, you know, it's interesting.
They're having these issues in their lives, but – the restorative aspect of going on a hunting trip with a friend, that would be something that would help them and help them work through some of what they're dealing with.
Right. And that's why Jess's wife left, by the way, because he went fishing too much. You know, I read blocks of my book out loud to my wife. She's my first reader. And she'll be sitting on the end of the couch, and I'll be reading along. She'll start nodding off, and she'll go, too much fishing, and then conk out. And then she's always right. I have to cut it in half. But yeah, Jess's wife is fed up with him being gone all the time, hunting and fishing.
It's, yeah.
Yeah.
Then as the story goes on, as you said, you're not planning this. You didn't go in with an ultimate plan, but you have to figure out, we know, and I assume you know right away, that you have to figure out how you get these characters. They have to find out what's going on, and then how do they move on?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have any ideas about it. I just, you know, followed them day to day, and I was often shocked by what happened.
In that shocking, how long does it take you to say, okay, I'm willing to go on this ride, to see where that shock brings you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all in right from the beginning. I do trust the process and trust the narrative flow. It's sort of like, I mean, I grew up doing a lot of river running. And what I loved about rivers, especially if they haven't been described or you don't know it, you get on this current and it could, you know, I think of narrative as a current, and you go into new territory and you come around a bend and you don't know what's going to be there. It could be a cougar drinking or a flight of backlit swallows or a waterfall, and you have to, you know, eddy out and scout. But I wanted that, when I was writing, I wanted that sense of adventure, in the writing. And so in some ways you just have to trust it. You know, you put your little craft of, you know, the novel on that current, and you just have to trust where it goes. And, you know, sometimes I do. I mean, I also another metaphor, you know, I can't help it. Us writers, we manufacture them. But is, you know, you ride a mountain horse who knows the country better than you, and you just give him his reins and he goes.
Right.
But every once in a while, because his brain is the size of a walnut, he wants to go down in that gully. He smells something down there or whatever. And you just have to pull the reins in, nudge him over and say, hey, let's go this way, Dandy. You know, we don't want to go there. So there is that little bit of, you know, that authorial control that, you know, that comes into play once in a while. And, you know.
Now, do you play with that at all and say, oh, okay, this is what happens if we go right, this is what happens if we go left?
I never do that, but I do nudge him over and then see what happens. And then I'm surprised again. But it's also following the energy too. You know, I just follow where my curiosity is, where the energy is, and where the fun is. I mean, even if it's like a super devastating, you know, heartrending situation or scene, but if I'm going there and I'm really curious about it and there's a lot of energy, then it's fun.
So how do you describe energy? How when the energy that you feel?
It's when your ears perk forward like a dog.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It is sort of like that. I mean, the authorial control thing is very interesting. So I wrote The Dog Stars. I went, you know, my first novel. I didn't know if it was even legal to sit down and start with the first line and have no clue. Like, no, real. I didn't know if anyone did it. You know, I thought the fiction police could bust down the door. But it was like, so I called a friend. There's some people here from our school, from our high school. And I called my friend Carlton, who was the showrunner for Lost. And, you know, he ran a lot of TV shows. He's a big writer in Hollywood, you know. Didn't seem that smart in high school, but he really was. Super, super smart, but just quiet. And I called him up and I said, hey, Carlton, you've worked with a lot of novelists. Do you know anybody who starts with the first line and has no clue? And he said, yeah. He didn't even hesitate. He said, I work with Stephen King, and he often starts with the first line, has no idea. The first line's a voice. The voice is a character. The character's in a situation or in a place, and then there's a situation because there's always a situation. And then he said something that surprised me. He said, I work with Elmore Leonard. He often starts with the first line. Those tightly plotted seeming novels in South Florida, crime novels in South Florida, he just, some guy's in a bar, you know, talking and off he goes. And so it kind of gave me permission. But so I wrote The Dog Stars that way. And then I thought I got to write the next novel as fast as I can before The Dog Stars is actually published so I don't get second novel syndrome. I'd heard about that. You know, when it makes a clamor, your debut, and then, you know, you freeze up. So I started on The Painter. When I wrote The Dog Stars, I would sit down and I'd go, don't think, just listen. And that's how I wrote it. When I wrote The Painter, a guy kills a guy with a rock because he saves a horse that this other guy's beating. And I called my editor and I said, should the guy, the victim, have a brother bent on vengeance? She said, yeah, of course. So I wrote the brother. And then I started thinking, this painter has a commission. Our killer has a commission in Santa Fe. When he goes to do it, should the brother follow him and stalk him and, you know, try and get vengeance? And then I started thinking, I'm thinking about it. This can't be good. And I was in the little tiny coffee shop in this town in western Colorado called Paonia, where the novel is set, in the very little coffee shop where our protagonist meets his model, who becomes his lover. And there's one table in this tiny space. And guess who was in there? Paolo Gacigalupi, the great science fiction writer. This guy's written, you know, he's won Andromeda Awards, Hugo Awards, he's a big blockbuster bestseller. And I started telling him about this dilemma, and this was so interesting. It's like the best thing I've ever heard. He's younger than me, and he picked up his coffee cup and he said, sit down, son. I want to tell you a story. I wrote one novel completely like fugue state. I kind of woke up and it was done. I love it. It won a big award. Second novel, I plotted every second of the narrative. I engineered the characters to interact a certain way. I sent it off. It won a big award and I love it. Now when I hold him up, I love them both and I can't tell the difference. And he leaned across the table and he said, your job is just to make sure it doesn't suck. And it was almost like the burden just lifted off my shoulders because I thought, I can do that. You know, what he was saying was so marvelous was rely on your craft. Take out the slow stuff, move it around, add stuff if you need to, but just rely on your craft. And the other wonderful thing was every story can have a different method. Don't worry about it.
So do you still look at all of them and feel equally about them?
Well, you love the first one in a special way because you actually got published. But yeah, I mean, it's like loving your children, right? They all have different characteristics.
You know, I don't surf. I know you're shocked. Kook is such a good book. Oh, my God. How did you do that?
Oh, thank you so much. I haven't read it. I mean, I never read it. So I don't know. I'm serious.
Oh, well, then you should sit down. It's really good.
I mean, I did.
No, it's very, very good.
That's funny. Thanks.
What was the impetus for that?
Well, the impetus was I had a 85 Vanagon that could barely walk. And I wanted to take it down the coast of Mexico, and I thought I could find a credulous publisher to bankroll the trip. So I did. The idea of the book was, could you drop everything in the middle of your life, pick up a surfboard, and drive down the coast of Mexico camping and surfing the whole way down, learning from people who were willing to teach you. And then in like 9 months, could you surf a big hollow wave like you see on TV, you know, starting being pushed on a foam board, you know, as a beginner. That was the premise.
And the fact that you – but that book – and I didn't realize it at the time, but that book is so – it has much of the – the energy, the excitement that you have in the novels, in that quest for finding out whether that can be achieved or not.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I wonder if it'd be fun to interview some other artists, like painters, different media. Because for me, like writing is, I'm sort of physically exuberant, and it's hard to sit still at a desk. You know, that was always the tension. Like, to be a good writer, you have to sit in a room at a desk, and you have to spend hours and hours doing that. And but the thing about writing is, and I wonder if painters feel the same way, I feel it feels like a physical activity that takes physical energy, not just mental energy. And you know, when I'm done with my quota of 1,000 words every, I'm just wasted. You know, it's all I can do to put on the shorts and go out and get exercise. And it's very interesting. My excitement about the writing is a physical excitement. It's strange.
The energy, the excitement. You are, and I say this very positively, but you are prolific. I mean, as you said, with the first novel, you go right into the second. You have a regular schedule. So that excitement then, like when you're done, then you're off to the races on the next one.
Well, part of it is that, you know, I grew up wanting to write fiction. I mean, when I was 11, I was in my little library in my little school in New York City. And the librarian, her name was Annie Bosworth, and I had a crush on her. She was English, and I would have married her like that day for the way she said my name. She said, "Pita. Yeah. Are you looking for something to read?" And, you know, I was like, thud. And a great librarian knows what you're ready for if they followed your reading since you were tiny, and like a great bookseller. And she went over to the fiction shelf, pulled off a little book called In Our Time by Ernest Hemingway. And it was those Nick Adams stories mostly up in Michigan. You got to picture a kid who loves the outdoors in the city reading that. I was like, my jaw dropped and my heart came out of me. I was like, I want to do that. I want to camp by the Big Two-Hearted River and make a fire and make cowboy coffee and not burn my tongue and fish for those trout. But really what I wanted, it was the first time I felt that prose go through my skin straight to my heart, kind of bypass the head. And I was like, I want to do that. I thought that when I was 11. I had to make a living after college, and so I wrote for magazines. And I did that for like 30 years. I was a journalist. And it was great. It was so fun. I mean, it was a joyful diversion. And I ended up writing about, you know, a lot of environmental stories. And so very fulfilling that way. And really, I felt like when I finally thought I had 9 months, that I didn't have to take a story. Maybe I had enough money saved up. I could write the novel I'd wanted to write since I was little. It was like coming home. It was like taking one hand from behind my back and writing with both hands. And so it's kind of, you know, doing what I wanted to do since I was a little boy. It's like, I don't want, you know, I'm going 100 miles an hour, man. I don't, you know, life is short, and I'm old.
You know? When you go out and you take the walk, and after you do your 1,000 words, and you're in nature and you're doing something out, are you noticing things? Like, do you file it away?
Yeah, I mean, it's like being a baleen whale, kind of. I find in my life that I'm always sifting. You're like a baleen whale. You're always getting little details. And I think, you know, that a lot of that has to do with the magazine work. That was great training. Because, you know, to write a magazine article that someone's not going to throw out in the dentist throwaway in the dentist's office after the first page. You got it. You got to establish a sense of place that's vivid, that transports the reader. You know, your characters have to jump alive, you know, off the page. So I learned a lot.
Does that help too in of having that experience of writing on deadline?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the discipline, you know, and also learning how much, like, because every magazine article, I mean, as you know, has a word count.
Right.
And so I got very used to how many words I could write with good energy, and that was helpful to know, like, what my daily quota would be.
Are there some days that you just can't achieve that?
No.
That's interesting.
No, because I don't – I'm not a – I don't mind writing bad stuff because I know, you know, like Paolo said, I know that I can throw it out, you know, after. So I just go – you know, I really believe in speed and momentum. And I tell kids when I'm – you know, a few times I teach, when you're not that smart, go for speed.
Do you know what's bad when you're doing it?
I don't know if I've achieved that level of self-awareness. I think there's days where you're on fire and, and there's other days, you know, you're just moving on that current.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the opposite, isn't it? Where you know when you got it, you know, when it's working really well.
Yeah.
And you're proud of it.
Right. And, you know, I don't mind throwing stuff out either. I mean, you know, like when you use that method where you start with the first line and go, like you make a lot of false starts. It's very inefficient, like extremely inefficient, because I'll work on something for 1 or 2 weeks and throw it out. And I might make 6 false starts before I get traction and go. So, you know, having a plan is probably a good idea.
Or not. Yeah. Peter Heller's new novel is Burn. It is published by Knopf. Peter Heller, thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you very much. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. Special thanks to Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, where this episode was recorded before a live audience. Northshire.com. The latest on National Productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at WAMC.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.